Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, all warm and cozy in our studio, raining outside, feeling very wintry. That's wintry here, if it's raining.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do winter any better than that. And so we're doing a little bit of Christmas open forum with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Thank you for returning for a second hour, Jimmy.
Oh, my pleasure.
Lots more Christmas questions for you.
Indeed.
Internet Christmas open forum. The next one comes from Jerry. I just heard, wait, am I in the right one? Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerry, I just heard a lady on a radio show. No need to be more specific, Jerry. Thank you. Say that when she went to catechism as a little girl, they were told that Joseph and Mary were cousins. I was like, what? That's what he wrote.
So this is not at all unreasonable. We know that they were both from Nazareth, and people who grew up in villages tended to marry other villagers, and over time, people in villages would become related to each other, not necessarily as first cousins, but in more distant cousin relationships. And in fact, the idea that you shouldn't marry your cousin is very modern. This cousin marriage, even first cousin marriage, has been actually quite common historically. Now, you will hear people say, well, you shouldn't marry your first cousin because of there could be genetic abnormalities and your child could have birth defects. And there has actually been studies of how much does it increase the chance of your child having birth defects, between 1% and 2%. It is very, very, very minor of an effect. Now, if you do it generation after generation, like European royalty, you can get hemophilia being passed down or something within tightly, you know, narrowed circles. But just marrying a first cousin is there's already like a 3% to 4% chance of a birth abnormality, and marrying a cousin increases it by between 1% and 2%.
Yeah.
So this fear is overblown.
Yeah.
And as a result, people in the ancient world who didn't know anything about genetics, well, they knew when their kids had birth defects, and they didn't see them happening when they married cousins. So they married cousins. And there were various reasons for this. Travel was one of them. If people live in the same place, you're going to end up intermarrying.
Sure.
You know, if you're not traveling around because airplanes, trains, and automobiles haven't been invented yet and society is not highly mobile. Also, this was a way of keeping resources and things like that within the family, so the family was stronger as a whole. And it was very common until like the last 100 to 200 years for people, even in the West, to marry either first cousins or second cousins or something like that. And so it's not at all unreasonable to suppose that Joseph and Mary and everybody else living in Nazareth, which was a very tiny village, were related to each other in one way or another. So cousin hypothesis, while it's not, we can't prove it, it is not at all unreasonable.
So both came from Nazareth. Nazareth, not a teeming metropolis.
No, like, not even today, but it would have been even smaller
back
then.
Just a tiny place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Jerry. Appreciate the question. This one comes from Mandy. Do we know when the celebration of Christmas began in the church? What did it look like initially? How did it develop historically? How did we get to the cultural celebrations related to Christmas that we experience in modern times?
So originally, we don't have any evidence of Christians celebrating Christmas. And in fact, there was some we do have some evidence that various groups of Christians looked kind of askance at Christmas, or at the idea of celebrating birthdays in general. You don't find a lot of birthdays in Scripture. There's only two people who celebrate birthdays in Scripture. One of them is Pharaoh, Herod, who ends up putting John the Baptist to death. And so these are both viewed as negative figures, as bad guys. And ordinary people frequently didn't even remember when they were born, because why bother? I'm illiterate.
Yeah.
You know, it's not relevant to my life to know exactly what day I was born on. We're not big into record keeping here in the village full of illiterates.
Mm-hmm.
And so lots of people have no idea. I mean, they may remember if you happen to be, oh, yeah, he was born on Passover. Well, you might remember that. Or he was born in the spring.
Yeah.
But exactly what year, I'm kind of fuzzy on. And this is very common even today in a lot of societies that don't have the level of record keeping and numeracy that we do here in America. And so, so you know who did keep records in ancient society?
Those Romans.
The rich people.
Oh, yeah.
And the royal people who had to run an administrative state.
Yeah.
And so what you find is the rich royal people in the ancient world celebrated birthdays, but at least they did more than ordinary people. And because there's always class resentment,
mm-hmm.
ordinary people looked at those rich people having fabulous feasts and getting drunk and doing immoral stuff on their birthdays and partly envied it, but also resented it.
Sure.
And so this led to a culture where ordinary people, even in the church initially, didn't like birthday celebrations. And so, and we have early evidence of that, like at the end of the 2nd century and the beginning of the 3rd century, of Christians saying, real Christians don't celebrate birthdays.
Yeah.
Now, this was a matter of culture, and our culture is different, and that's fine. But the fact that you had this anti-birthday sentiment in many Christian circles meant that a lot of Christians early on did not celebrate anybody's birthday, including Christ. It wasn't considered holy. Instead, what you wanted to celebrate as someone's birthday was their death day, because that's the day they're born into the next life in heaven. And so so you would find that as an equivalent for birthday celebrations. And thus, the celebration of Jesus' death began immediately, his death and resurrection. That's Easter and Good Friday. I mean, those go all the way back to the 1st century.
Mm-hmm.
But you did have some church fathers discussing days on which they believed Christ was born, even though they didn't celebrate it. So it seems that there was a discussion of his birth and when it occurred that developed, at least from what the evidence suggests, before they began a liturgical celebration. And so when did the first liturgical celebration of Christmas happen? Well, there's a document known as the Chronography of 354, which is a document dealing with liturgical timetables and stuff that was written in the year 354. And it records that, 18 years previously, in 336, that there had been a celebration of Christ's birth on December 25th in Rome. And so that would seem to be the first recorded December 25th celebration of Christ's birth. It was a local one in Rome in 336. In terms of what it looked like, probably the only way it differed from a normal celebration of Mass, because they didn't have elaborate Christmas decorations and stuff, was just they mentioned Christ's birth in the prayers of the Mass on that day.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably it. And then over the course of time, additional customs developed. They varied from place to place. And so you would have different Christmas customs in one area compared to another area. And from one time to another time. So there's been a lot of variation. In terms of when our modern Christmas iconography developed, that, at least here, the iconography we have in the U.S. with the Santa Claus and the reindeer and all that stuff, that developed here in America. One of the key roles now, so Saint Nicholas is the basis of Santa Claus. And you might wonder, how do you get Santa Claus
from
St. Nicholas? Well, okay, so New York was originally, early on, was settled by the Dutch. And so, like, New York City was originally New Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had these Dutch settlers who came over. And in Dutch, Saint Nicholas is Sinterklaas. And St. Nicholas gave us Sinterklaas in Dutch, which gave us Santa Claus in English.
Oh, okay.
And the updated St. Nicholas figure was then just like you see people, you know, like drawing religious figures in terms of their own time because they don't know what ancient clothing looked like.
Sure, yeah.
And so that's what happened with St. Nicholas. People in New Amsterdam didn't know what a 4th century Turkish bishop dressed like. And they couldn't just go on Wikipedia and look it up. And so they envisioned St. Nicholas as a modern-looking Dutchman, and which is where you get, like, if you're dressed for the winter, you got the fur-lined clothing, which you wouldn't necessarily need in Turkey, although you might. But this is where some of the iconography comes from. His suit is based on what people at the time used as winter wear, including the boots. It's where the pipe smoking comes from. It's the cap and all of that. That's a kind of Dutch-American makeover of St. Nicholas. And then in 1844, Clement Moore, a poet, published the very famous poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, which is the one that has the eight tiny reindeer and with the name, you know, Dasher and Donner and Blitzen and all that stuff. And those he's drawing on earlier traditions, but it was that poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, that cemented a lot of the Santa Claus Christmas iconography in people's minds.
Right.
And then in the 1940s, I guess it was, I believe it was Macy's, for a marketing push, wanted to add the ninth reindeer, Rudolph.
Oh.
And they got, who was it? It was it Gene Autry?
Who did
the song, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
I think Burl Ives.
May have been more than one.
Okay.
But so we've had this growth of Christmas iconography over time, and it continues to happen. In 2005, we got the Shelf on the Elf, or the Elf on the Shelf, and we also got Krampus in the early 2000s. And so it just changes and evolves over time. By the way, in Japan, Santa Claus lives on the moon.
Thank you, Japan. That makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
Japanese are very
sensible. Helps with conquering the Martians, too.
I know. You got a little head start there. All right. Thank you very much, Mandy. That was very, very interesting. Somebody said to me the other day that the earliest celebrations of Christmas involved fasting. And I don't remember who said it. It was somebody on the show. You don't remember? I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, repeating unsubstantiated rumors is what we're all about here on Catholic Answers Live.
I guess so. I had the hope that you might fill that in for me, but I guess not.
I have no knowledge of that.
All right. Jason asks, Jason, you're going to have to wait. Hang on, Jason, right back after this. More open forum of the Christmas variety right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Wings is a weekly newsletter that's packed with program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at EWTN. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Merry Christmas to you. Hope it's going well this Christmas season for you. We've got Jimmy Akin here with us answering Christmas questions. These are all Christmas questions that came from the internet. Next one comes from Lauren. Lauren asks, wait, let me just make sure I'm on the right one. No, I said I was going to do Jason. Lauren, you got to wait. Before I went to the break, I said I was going to Jason's question. What is the likelihood that the famous cave in Bethlehem is the true site of Christ's birth?
So I haven't done a detailed study of the archaeology of the Bethlehem Grotto, but based on what knowledge I do have, I think there's a significant likelihood that it really is where Jesus was born. We have very early evidence that Jesus was born in a cave. That's information. It doesn't come to us from the Gospels, but it does come to us from the second century, because in the second century, the infancy Gospel of James was written, also known as the Proto-Evangelium of James, and it is explicit about the fact that Jesus was born in a cave. And there is local tradition that goes back to at least the 400s, mm-hmm. The 300s, the 4th century, that this is the cave itself, mm-hmm. Because the current Basilica of the Nativity in Bethlehem, it was one of the holy sites that was visited by the Emperor Constantine's mother in the early 300s when she came and did her tour of the Holy Land. And so I know the tradition that this was the cave was there in the early 300s. We have explicit testimony that it was in a cave in the mid-100s, so that's not a big gap. And there may be additional indicators as well, but I'd have to do further study to determine that.
All right. Jason, thank you very, very much for the question. By the way, I looked it up and you were right. Gene Autry was first. Uh-huh. Burl Ives recorded after Gene Autry.
Yeah, hey, Burl Ives would have done it perhaps for the Rankin-Bass animated special.
Yeah. This one comes from Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something I see asked in Catholic women's groups. Given that we now understand virginity as more than physical integrity, how do we understand Mary's virginity during the act of the birth of Christ? The Church Fathers have some things to say about this from their historical perspective, but why is this important, if it is, for us today?
So the Church teaches that Mary remained a virgin throughout her entire life. Mm-hmm. And so this means that she was a virgin before her act of giving birth, before her parturition. So she was a virgin ante parte, and then she was a virgin in parte in the act of giving birth, and she was a virgin postpartum after giving birth. And what that means physically is something that has been subject to different interpretations over the course of time. Today, we tend to think of virginity as meaning has not had sex with a person. Mm-hmm. You know, someone's a virgin if they have not had sex. But historically, there has also been an understanding of virginal integrity that goes beyond that and involves the preservation of a particular membrane, and that is often ruptured when a child is born.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have in older sources this broader understanding of what it means to preserve one's virginal integrity. And in terms of what the Church teaches, there is a diversity of opinion about how the Church's teaching that Mary preserved her virginity through her entire life is to be understood. There are recent figures who have said, well, you got to stick with the old understanding. But there have also been recent figures, theologians, who have said, no, as long as Mary never had relations with anybody,
yeah,
that would be sufficient. And so we wouldn't need to propose a miraculous birth for Jesus. And to the modern mind, it could even be like, why would you even want to bother proposing that?
Yeah.
Well, it did get proposed, and it got proposed astonishingly early. The idea that Jesus had a miraculous birth is found in the Ascension of Isaiah, which is a first century Christian writing that appears to date from the year 67.
That is very early. That's during the writing of the New Testament.
It's during the writing of the New Testament. It's before the writing of the book of Revelation. And so you had first century Christians reporting that Jesus had a miraculous birth where he basically there was a big in the version in the Ascension of Isaiah is there's a big light and all of a sudden Jesus as a baby is there and Mary is no longer pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a very, very early tradition, and as a result, even though I understand the modern sensibility of, you know, why would you want to suppose this, we do actually have some very early evidence for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not canonical. It's not guaranteed to be true, but it is, you know, this is not an inspired document, but it is very early, and so I have to take that seriously. Now, in terms of why would this matter, it's essentially a subcase of why does Jesus have a virgin birth at all?
Yes.
Because if Mary remains a virgin for her whole life, well, okay, she never had relations with anybody. Why is it important that Jesus have a virginal conception? Well, it's to prove that he's the Son of God. Now, God could have sent his son into the world in another way. He could have had a human father, sire Jesus. That's how he could have gotten the genetic material for half of Jesus' personal genome through a human father. That's totally possible. God could have done that, but he chose not to. And the apparent reason why God chose not to is to underscore the fact, this is my son.
Yeah.
In a distinct and unique way that does not apply to anybody else.
Right, right.
And so if that's the reason for the virginal conception in the first place, that would seem to be the reason for or the significance for the preservation of Mary's virginity throughout her life. Because if she later has ordinary children through the ordinary means, then you can always – there'll be a doubt of,
yeah.
Well, you know – did she and Joseph or someone else maybe get together early on? And by having her virginity preserved throughout her life, it makes the point that, I mean, you can choose not to believe it, but it makes the point if you are a believer, no, this Jesus is totally unique as the Son of God, and that's why God chose to do it this way.
Lauren, thank you very, very much for that question. Appreciate it. It's an internet Christmas open forum. Jimmy Aiken is our guest. Patrick asks this. Here's a nice short question. How little was O Little Town of Bethlehem?
So we know that in the ancient world it was quite small. Micah 5:2 says it was the smallest of the families of Judah, although that could be hyperbole. It might not have been the literal smallest. Today, there are about 30,000 people living in Bethlehem, but are the best estimate of its size in the first century that I'm aware of was proposed by the archaeologist and New Testament scholar William F. Albright. And based on the research he did, Albright concluded that in the first century, Bethlehem was 100 times smaller than it is today, that it only had 300 people living there.
Okay.
And he further then said, okay, so how many, given that, if there were 300 people there, how many of those would have been killed in the slaughter of the innocents? How many boys would have been 2 years old or younger at the time? And he estimated it would have been 6 or 7. So we shouldn't imagine the slaughter of the innocent as this massive thing. Sometimes you hear people say, well, why isn't it in the records? Well, one, because we don't have a record of most things that happened.
Yeah, right.
But if it involved 6 or 7 boys,
right,
you wouldn't expect a record of it. It would have been very distressing if you're one of the parents of those kids,
right,
and to the people in Bethlehem, but it's not the kind of thing that you would expect a big court write-up to be written up and preserved in Herod's archives, which we don't have anyway.
All right, Patrick, thank you very, very much for that question.
So Herod killed lots of people, 6 or 7 little kids. That's a very tiny fraction of the deaths Herod was responsible for.
Among the people he killed, lots of his own relatives, including his own children.
Yes, and one of his wives and things like that. There's a statement attributed to, and I don't know, this is probably apocryphal, but in the ancient Roman literature, there's a statement attributed to the Emperor Augustus of saying it would be better to be Herod's pig than to be Herod's son.
And it would.
And the joke is because Herod's a Jew, he's not going to kill his pig to eat it. But he does kill his sons and more than one of them.
He did indeed. Yeah. More on Christmas coming up right after this. All of our questions from the internet. The internet has questions about Christmas. Jimmy Akin's got answers. We'll have more of those answers on Catholic Answers Live as we continue with our internet Christmas open forum. Merry Christmas and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest, and we're taking all the questions from the internet today. And they're all related to Christmas. They're all Christmas questions of one kind or another for Jimmy. And this one comes from Christopher, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. How long after the birth of Jesus did the Magi arrive? Based on Herod's slaughter of those boys up to 2 years old, It could have been up to 2 years, right? Certainly not 12 days.
Correct. And so the what Matthew tells us is that Herod slaughtered all the baby boys in Bethlehem that were 2 years old and under, in keeping with the time that he learned from the Magi. Mm-hmm. And so this is up to 2 years later. Now, the question is it a full 2 years later? And I think that the answer is no, for a couple of reasons. One, if the Magi had told Herod that the baby was born exactly 2 years ago, Then he wouldn't need to kill all of the ones that were less than a year old.
Oh, right. He killed everybody up to two.
Everybody up to two. And that indicates some ambiguity about exactly how old Jesus was in Herod's mind. So they gave him a chronological indicator, but it didn't tell Herod the exact, or didn't convince Herod of the exact age of the baby Jesus, because then he could have just gone and, okay, where's the 24-month-old?
Yeah, you right.
And so this suggests that Herod is being cautious, since he's not going for a specific age, but for an age range, that suggests he's being cautious to try to make sure he gets the up and comer, and that would suggest that the true answer is somewhere in the middle, from Herod's perspective, and he's padding on both sides of the age he thinks Jesus really is. Mm-hmm. So he's giving himself margin for error.
Yeah.
And since two and under is the range, that would suggest, now if I was Herod, I would say, I mean, number one, I wouldn't be killing babies. But
good job, Jimmy.
If I were, if I was Herod, I would say, okay, I think he's about a year old, so I'm going to kill everybody 12 months on either side of that, just to make sure I get him. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it was not a full 2 years. I think it was more likely a year. And I have a second reason for saying that. It could have been a little more than a year, but I think it probably was not a full 2 years, because the evidence we have from the church fathers and from the Gospel of Luke is that Jesus was born in the 28th year of Augustus Caesar, as reckoned from the Battle of Actium. Actium was a sea battle off the coast of Greece in which Augustus defeated the forces of Mark Antony and Cleopatra. Mm-hmm. And this allowed him to consolidate the power in Rome in a single person, himself. Because previously, like Mark Antony and Augustus and another guy had been members of the triumvirate. But after Actium, all the power got concentrated in him.
Yeah.
And so it was common to use Actium as one of the dates to count as the beginning of his reign. So according to the church fathers, Christ was born in the 28th year of Augustus from Actium. And that would mean that Christ was born either in the second half of the year 3 BC or the first half of the year 2 BC.
Okay.
Because the 28th year of Augustus straddled
those
our year. So then when did Herod die? Well, you'll often hear that Herod died in 4 BC. This is nonsense. Herod did not die in 4 BC. The actual evidence is that Herod, and there have been various scholars pointing this out recently, the actual evidence is that Herod died in the first half of 1 BC. So if Jesus is born in the latter half of 3 or the first half of 2, and you go forward a year, mm-hmm. that's the latter half of 2 or the first half of 1. And the first half of 1 is when the evidence says that that Herod actually died, because he died in conjunction with an eclipse.
Okay, so you have a good dating of it.
Yeah. And so if Herod died in the first half of 1 and Jesus was born in the 28th year of Augustus, it's like a year to a year and a half at most after Jesus' birth. Right. So I think that's additional evidence that Herod was padding from when the wise men arrived.
I got to say, this makes Herod even a bigger jerk. Mm-hmm. He's not going to be around for the baby to grow up even.
No, yeah.
Like
he was already
like,
dying.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I don't mean to call people jerks. I really don't. But I'm not in favor of this Herod guy at all. I now have very distinct negative feelings about him. It's our Christmas open forum. All the questions coming from the internet. This one's from...
Oh, to give a little bit more Herod charitability, perhaps.
Yeah.
Even if he didn't see the child grow up, he might survive long enough for the child to become the focus of a rebellion.
Oh, I see.
Against
yeah,
him.
Yeah, right.
Because it's like, hey, if this is the rightful king of the Jews, let's knock over that Herod guy and we'll just have this guy on the throne as a baby and put in a regent to
yeah.
manage things.
Oh, yeah, right. And out you go, Herod. Thanks. Thanks for your service. Yeah, it was not easy to be a king in that part of the world in those days.
No, although it was easier when you had the might of the Roman state backing you up.
Yeah, yeah. I think Herod had to make a few trips to Rome to assure that, right? Because there was a couple of times he was like, I better go see Caesar.
Especially early on, yeah. That's how he became king, is he kind of was involved in some double dealing, but he ended up getting the, because he was a tricky guy,
yeah.
But he ended up getting the Roman Senate to endorse him as king.
The next one comes from Philip. Oh, okay. And it's somewhat related. I'm curious about the timeline between the Holy Family's arrival in Bethlehem for the birth of Jesus and their departure and return from Egypt. How long were they in Bethlehem? How long were they in Egypt?
So that's why I wanted to do the previous question right before this one, because it establishes our basic timeline.
Okay.
So if Jesus is born in the second half of 3 or the first half of 2 BC,
yep.
then and the wise men arrive a year or a year to a year and a half later, then it's possible that the Holy Family could have stayed in Bethlehem for that time. It's also possible that they could have gone back to Nazareth and come back to Bethlehem when the wise men arrived. Apparently, Joseph either had family in both places that he could stay with, or he had property in both places,
mm-hmm.
maybe both. And so every year for the three pilgrimage festivals, which we know Mary and Joseph observed, they would come down from Nazareth and presumably stay in Bethlehem, because it's like 6 miles from Jerusalem.
Right, right.
And if they already had family or property there, it would make it a logical place for them to stay during the pilgrimage feasts. So either the Holy Family stayed in Bethlehem for that year to year and a half, or they left and came back, which they would have done anyway periodically. In terms of the flight to Egypt, well, we don't know exactly where in Egypt they went. There is a major colony. There was a major colony of Jews in Alexandria. Now, Alexandria is up at the top of Egypt, on the Mediterranean coast. And if you visualize Egypt, you have the Nile River coming northward, and then it fans out into the Nile Delta. And on one side of the Nile Delta, you have Israel. And then you have you have Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula, and then you move over into Egypt, and you encounter one branch of the Nile Delta. Well, Alexandria is on the other side of the Nile Delta from that. So it's possible they went all the way to Alexandria to be in that Jewish community. It's also possible they went elsewhere because there were groups of Jews elsewhere in Egypt. In fact, there was even a Jewish temple that was located in Egypt in Leontopolis, if I recall correctly, either that or Heliopolis. But I believe it was Leontopolis. But in any event, Alexandria would be a good spot to go. And it wouldn't be that hard to reach. It's only about 360 miles from Bethlehem. So if you're Joseph and you're in Bethlehem and you get this warning, don't, you know, get out of Dodge. It's 360 miles to get to Alexandria. If you walked or ride 20 miles a day, you'll be there in 18 days. On the other hand, they may not have gone that far. It's possible they could have. They would have been on the other, on the near side of the Nile Delta. That's just 200 miles away, so it would be 10 days to get there. So they go there, and then because we have this evidence that if it was like a year to a year and a half later, we're already in the first half of 1 BC, which is when Herod dies. So the odds are they did not stay in Egypt that long. They got over there. They got word that Herod had died. The angel appears and says, you can go back. Everyone who's trying to kill the child is gone. And then they came back. Joseph learns that Archelaus, Herod's son, has been appointed to rule in Judea. So he says, let's not go to the family in Bethlehem. Let's head back up to north Nazareth.
Fascinating. Philip, thank you. As a matter of fact, Christopher and Philip, both, thank you for that, those questions. It's an open forum all about Christmas. All of our questions have come from the internet. We got a bunch more. We'll do those right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with a gospel message. You can enjoy EWTN live TV and radio streams, EWTN news, program schedules, prayers, and devotionals with the EWTN app. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back. Merry Christmas. Catholic Answers Live here. Jimmy Akin in studio with us, taking questions from the internet all about Christmas. We've covered a lot of good Christmas questions. People have a lot of Christmas questions.
They do.
I wasn't sure that we would have this many, but that's a lot of Christmas
questions.
Oh, and
this is even skimming out the duplicates and all the jokey non-questions that people put in the feed when they think they're being funny, but it takes my time to read them and cut them out.
Talking to you, Internet. Let's go to John's question. It's not really even a question. It's just a statement about John, but I assume he means it as a question. John says, I'm curious about the star that led the wise men.
Well, so am I, and so are a lot of other people. There has been a lot of discussion of what the star could have been, and unfortunately, it is difficult to say with certainty, and I and for a couple of reasons. At least a couple of reasons. One of them is in order to know what the, there are a bunch of things the star could have been, but you need to know which, in order to establish which it was, you need to know two things which are very hard to know. The first one is exactly when Jesus was born. And because if you're proposing, if he's born in 3 BC or 2 BC, and you're saying, oh, well, Herod died in 4 BC, so Jesus must have been born in 6 or 7 BC.
Oh, right. Then
you're looking in the wrong set of years for what the star could have been. And this is a big problem in studies of the Star of Bethlehem, because lots of people are using the wrong date for Jesus' birth. There's a very famous horoscope. There's this guy, I'm blanking on his name, but there's this guy who has done a lot of work and very good work in horoscopes for historical individuals like Augustus. It turns out if you look at Augustus's natal horoscope, his birth horoscope, it just screams world ruler.
Oh, it does.
At you. Yeah.
How interesting.
And given the Greco-Roman way of interpreting astrology.
Right. And, so just to be clear, there would have been different horoscopes locally. Like, so the way the Romans understood the stars.
Correct.
Different than, say, the Babylonians or the Sumerians.
Correct.
Or, okay.
So, and I'm about to get to that.
Okay.
So under the Greco-Roman system, Augustus has this amazing horoscope that would scream world ruler at you, and which is one of the reasons that Augustus was kind of private about some of this information, especially early on. But there's this guy who's done all this scholarly work on like horoscopes in this period and what they would have meant to people. Problem number one, he's using the wrong birthday for Jesus.
Okay.
So he's got an amazing horoscope for Jesus.
But it's not when Jesus was born.
But it's in the wrong year.
Yeah.
And so so that's one problem with his analysis. The other problem with his analysis is he's relying on Greco-Roman astrology.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's more than one system of astrology in this part of the world. And so, Cy Kellett, with your knowledge of geography.
Yes.
You think about Israel.
Yes.
Are Greece and Rome to the west or the east of Israel?
They are to the west.
Correct. Were the wise men from the west or the east of Israel?
They are from the east.
So you would not expect them to be using the Greco-Roman system of astrology, which is the other problem with this guy's horoscope for Jesus.
Yeah.
You would expect them to be using one of the eastern systems of astrology. Now, the one that we know the most about is the Babylonian.
Okay.
Because the Babylonians not only wrote a lot— they wrote on clay tablets, and clay tablets survive well. In fact, you know, when we have a problem in the West, they would write on papyrus and parchment and stuff, and your house burns down, your library goes up with it.
Yeah.
Well, in the East, you got all your clay tablets, and your library burns down, and the clay tablets get hardened and survive better.
Yeah, right.
So,
plus they're under a protective pile of rubble.
Yeah, and ash and stuff.
Right.
So, so we have all of these clay tablets from Mesopotamia, and we understand the Sumerian and Babylonian systems of astrology quite well. And there have recently been some attempts to analyze the Star of Bethlehem in those terms and say, well, what kind of signal? Now, unfortunately, there are other groups like the Nabataeans. We don't know as much about their system.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Babylonian system, we do. And there have been recent attempts to analyze the Star of Bethlehem and say, what would have told Babylonian magi that a king had been born in Judea, and that you might want to go visit him? And there is an answer to that question. It involves the planet Jupiter, which was the king star. It's because it's the biggest planet.
Yeah.
It's the king star. I mean, we know that a little better now than they did then, but it was understood as the star representing the king. And it actually has a very interesting role in Babylonian astrology. Jupiter was very closely linked to the king. In fact, there are certain, if Jupiter behaves a certain way in the sky, it's a sign that the king is going to die. And so they had, I think I may have told you this before.
Now I'm remembering. I love this system.
The Babylonians had a system for dealing with it. If Jupiter behaves the way in the sky that indicates the king is going to die, how do you deal with it? Because you don't want the real king. The real king does not want to die.
No.
So what you do is you take a condemned prisoner who's going to die anyway, and you make him like king for a month. And you've got the real king dressing like a farmer, and he's putting on farmer clothing, and everyone's talking about the real king as if he's
not
a farmer.
The king. Totally not the king.
Totally not the king.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it's this other guy over here is the king.
Right.
And then at the end of the month, you put him to death.
Yeah.
And
that takes
so
care of that.
Turns, Jupiter said the king was going to die. The technical king died, and now the other king gets to resume his reign. So this is the substitute king system.
Yeah.
Well, there was a constellation. I want to say it's Aries, but there was a constellation in Babylonian astrology that was associated with Judea. It was like, this is the constellation for the West and for Judea in particular. And so if you have this king thing in the sky happening, involving Jupiter, happening with the right constellation to signal you need to go west and it's to Judea, that would tell you Judean king has been born. And there's another sign in conjunction with this in Babylonian astrology that would indicate like a major king is going to be born that's going to affect the destiny of Mesopotamia.
I see.
So maybe you want to send a friendship delegation there first to
right.
make peace with him so that it goes well for you.
Yeah.
And so there are a number. We need to do a whole separate show, maybe a focus on this understanding of the Star of Bethlehem and to get the details. But there are indications in Babylonian astrology that would signal something like this and motivate the Magi to go over there.
Fascinating. Thanks very much. I forget now who that was from.
John.
Yeah, John. Thank you for sharing that question. Christmas Open Forum, Joanne asks this. Is it true that the temple lambs were wrapped in swaddling clothes to keep them perfect for sacrifice? I heard that recently as an explanation why the angel's message to the shepherds was a sign that Jesus was the Lamb of God who would be sacrificed for us.
So number one, I've never heard this claim.
Okay.
And I'm very doubtful of it. Because for one thing, we know that they weren't always, because if you go to like some of the last of the 12 prophets in the Old Testament, like Malachi definitely, I think maybe in Haggai as well, God is complaining about the inferior quality of the sacrifices.
Oh, yeah.
And saying, look, you wouldn't give this as a gift to your governor.
Yeah.
Why are you giving this blind, lame animal to me?
Right.
And so obviously they were not always taking great care.
Here, God, you have this one.
Yeah. The blind and lame one that I can't sell.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So certainly they didn't always take this kind of care. Also, this is just such a cute, touching little story. It's like too good to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't fit with the purpose, with the text in Luke. When the angels appear to the shepherds, they say, go over to Bethlehem. You're going to find this child in swaddling clothes lying in a manger, and this will be a sign for you. Okay. So, Kellett,
yes,
if
sir.
Someone told you
yeah.
that if you go to a certain location, you're going to find a baby in a diaper lying in a manger—
Yeah.
What's the sign for you? The fact it's wearing a diaper
or
the fact that it's in a manger?
Yeah, that might stand out a little bit more.
Yeah, because diapers are normal baby wear
right.
in our society. Well, swaddling clothes were normal baby wear in their society. So if you're told, go and find this baby, you're going to expect it to be swaddled.
Right.
The fact it's in a manger is what you're not going to expect. And so structurally in the text in Luke— or exegetically in the text in Luke, it's the fact the baby is lying in a manger that's the sign, not the fact that it's in swaddling clothes. And that would suggest that, oh, well, lambs were also swaddled to keep them perfect. It's like, this doesn't ring true.
Yeah.
This sounds like a pious little legend that someone has thought of, but it does not ring true. And it would not have been the fact it's in swaddling clothes that was a sign for the shepherds.
Right, like all the other babies. No swaddling clothes for them. We're laying them all in mangers all over the place, but no swaddling. No, that's not it. Joanne has another question, so mm-hmm. I want to do that one too. Any idea how old Joseph was? Orthodox indicate he was much older than Mary, but Bishop Sheen and Father Calloway believe he was young. Would an old man likely make the trip to Egypt on foot easily?
Well, so in terms of how old Joseph was, the earliest evidence we have supports the view that is common in the East, that he was significantly older than Mary. In the infancy gospel of James, which dates from the second century, when Joseph is initially proposed to become Mary's guardian, he says, "I'm an old man." Unfortunately, he doesn't say how old.
Yeah,
I mean, I need to check. I assume the word in Greek there is presbyteros, but that can mean 40 and up.
Yeah,
you know, given the mortalities, pattern of the day, and so so I don't know that he was that old. I mean, he was older than Mary, but if he was 45 or 50 or 55, you can go on long trips. You know,
yeah.
And you're maybe not making them as fast as if you were an 18-year-old who wants to run.
Right, yeah.
But you have no problem. In fact, you know, they would do these caravans from, as a village, from Nazareth down to Jerusalem 3 times a year. That's a 100-mile trip.
Yeah.
And so whatever age Joseph was, he didn't have problems doing 100-mile trips. And in an emergency circumstance where they're going to kill your foster son.
Yeah.
Well, could he have made the trip to Egypt on foot easily? Well, maybe not easily, but this is an emergency.
Yeah.
And you're going to do what you need to do to get there. Also, according to the Eastern view and the Proto-Evangelium or the Infancy Gospel of James, he had adult sons that would have helped them get there. And they would have traveled as a family, and so it wouldn't have just all fallen to Joseph. So I don't see this as being a decisive objection, the trip to Egypt, any more than, and for a variety of reasons, I tend to favor the older view of Joseph on evidential grounds.
Joanne, you ended us with two really good questions, but lots and lots of great Christmas questions. Thanks everyone who gave us those Christmas questions. And thanks, Jimmy Akin, for coming in, answering a whole lot of Christmas questions.
My pleasure, and Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you, and enjoy, if you're going to watch it again.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians?
Conquers the Martians, yeah.
Yeah.
Darren, thanks. Thanks, everybody in the booth. What's tomorrow, do we know? Let's do Catholic Answers Live.
We'll find out.
Let's do a live show. Let's do a
recorded live show.
Pre-record tomorrow. This is not going well. See you then, God willing. Catholic Answers Live.